The music's on, the disco ball has dropped, and it's time to get this party started. You're listening to episode 36 of Disco Trek, a Star Trek Discovery After Party podcast here on the Tricorder Transmissions Network. Tonight, I am your host, Jeff Hewlett. Unfortunately, Heather Barker has had a family emergency and will not be able to be with us this week. We send her all of our best and hope that she's doing well and holding up well, and look forward to her coming back hopefully next week. But here with me in Heather's co-chair spot is the host of our Shore Leave podcast here on Tricorder Transmissions. And you've heard her many times on Disco Trek before. The wonderful Marina Kravchuk is here. How are you, Marina?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me, Jeff. I know I'm a poor replacement for Heather, but I'll try to be not too blinded by the disco ball and hopefully do a good job.
Oh, you always do a good job. You were just here, what, last week?
Last week, yeah. So technically, it doesn't count, I suppose. So
because you're a host, yeah.
I'm hosting this time, and last time I was a guest, so
yeah,
I'm good.
I guess the rules don't necessarily have to apply to Tricorder family, do they?
Yeah.
But speaking of the rules, I'm going to get into this in a little bit, but in case people didn't catch this out there on the internet or on our previous episode, the rules for Disco Trek guests has changed a little bit. We used to have it where you couldn't come back on the show more than once in a season, but now the rule is a little bit more lax, and you can come back as long as it's not two episodes in a row, and we will go through how you can get on the show here in a few minutes. But for people who aren't familiar with the podcast, we are a community-based Star Trek discotheque of sorts, focusing on each episode of Discovery right after they air. And tonight we are going to be discussing If Memory Serves. So I'm pretty excited about this. It's a very Spock-heavy episode. So we are going to get into this in a minute, but we have a little bit of housekeeping to do. Oh, and first, let me introduce our guest with us tonight from our Star Trek community. She's returning to Disco Trek for the second time this season, making use of that new rule change. Heather Kirby is back with us. How are you, Heather?
I'm good. Thank you for having me once again. Yes, I jumped at the opportunity to make full use of the new rule change.
Well played.
On the season premiere of season two, talking about Brother. So at least I waited about halfway through the season to come back on and talk with you guys.
You did. But welcome back.
It's only fitting because at least you still have a Heather on the podcast tonight.
That's true. Good point. Right. Good point. We have an auxiliary Heather for this podcast. So it's wonderful to have you back again. We had a lot of fun talking about the season premiere, and I'm anxious to hear about what you have to say about this episode. But before we jump into that discussion, we have a few things that we want to mention. So as we mentioned before, Disco Trek is community focused, and it has evolved from our desire to give fans in our convention community a chance to talk about Star Trek Discovery. So to enter for your chance to join us on this show, make sure you're a member of the unofficial Star Trek Las Vegas convention group on Facebook. Once you do that, you will see a new post early every week with the Disco Trek image and some information on the following weekend's recording for that episode. We've been really focusing on getting things done on Sundays, but it does vary up. It may be Saturday or Sunday, so check the post to make sure you can see what day that episode is going to record. All you have to do is comment on that post to be entered into our drawing, and we will randomly choose two members to be on the podcast. So as we've mentioned, the new rule, once you've been on the podcast, you can't be on the following week, but you can be on the week after that and beyond. So keep that in mind. And we would like all of you guys out there to throw your hats into the ring so that you have your chance to talk about Star Trek Discovery. And if you haven't heard enough of me rambling on, you're going to have to listen a little longer because we have a Patreon page that we mention here on the show every week. You can find it at patreon.com/thetricordertransmissions or by visiting our website, thetricordertransmissions.com, and clicking on the big orange Patreon link in the upper right-hand corner. So if you enjoy what we do here on Disco Trek or on any of our shows here on Tricorder Transmissions or like Marina's show, Shore Leave, please think about joining our list of patrons. Becoming a patron will give you instant access to our unedited and early release recordings, often several days or a week before they're available to the general public. So like this show right now will be available later this evening in its unedited format on Patreon for any patron who doesn't matter what level you're on, or how much you donate, you will have access to all of those materials. But we do have tiers that we've recently implemented, and there are several of them with different benefits that escalate as we go up. The tiers are transparent aluminum, trillium D, latinum, dilithium omega molecule, and harmonized omega molecule, each with their own set of exclusive benefits just for you. And one of those benefits that's available for Trillium D, which is a $5 a month and higher donation, is a video by John Gregorian, host of Trek Profiles, which is just posted a couple of days ago. It's a behind-the-scenes video that shows John and his adorable son cooking up some dishes from the Neelix cookbook, and that is only available to Trillium D and higher patrons. It's a riot. It's fun to watch. Everybody, if you haven't watched it yet and you're a patron at that level or higher, go back and check it out. It's really, really good. And as we were talking about before this episode started, we're working on other ideas for some behind-the-scenes videos for you guys out there. And before I close on the Patreon portion of this, we have a couple of new patrons we want to thank. So this week we got Brooke Horton, who is a Polytrex listener and fan of the network. Thank you for signing up, Brooke. And Mike Bovia, I hope I didn't mess up your name. Both of them are Trillium D level members, so thank you guys so much for that. And we also had our current patron, Eric Sycon, raised his pledge up to the next pledge level. So thank you so much, Eric. We really appreciate all of you guys and all of our Patreon family who give us so much and allow us to do a lot of the things that we do, like our Star Trek Las Vegas parties and all the buttons and swag that we're making for all of you guys out there. So it really helps us to grow the network and to give you more stuff. So thanks again to everybody who is part of our Patreon family, and I hope more of you out there will consider joining us. So that brings us to the rundown of how this show works. Marina, do you want to take us through the structure of the show?
Oh, yes, absolutely. So as usual, the show is segmented into three parts. We have Drop the Record, which is opening notes and general opinions about the episode. Play a new track. So what did we learn about the new, about anything new about the Star Trek universe? And Spin It Again, which is a look back at the things that really stood out throughout the episode, you know, characters, events, whatever, anything that is really worth looking at or talking about again. So let's take it away. Let's drop the record.
Yeah, we're going to drop
what did you guys think? Yeah. This is certainly one episode for history books, I could say.
It certainly is. I forgot to say. Guys, stay tuned at the end. We have a voicemail from our very good friend, Eric Muirhead of the Pershing Officers Club on Facebook, and we'll be playing that for you at the end of the episode. But let's get back to dropping that record. Heather, since you are our only guest this week, why don't you kick us off? What stood out to you? What's your opening remarks, your reaction to this episode?
This episode was definitely epic. I mean, it's something that will go down in the history books when it comes to Star Trek and the universe and the greater story. One of the things that I really loved about it, and it's one of the things I love about Discovery, is that considering as much as people want to criticize the fact that it's set before most of the Star Trek universe that we know, it's given us an opportunity to take just tiny little I don't want to call it a hole, but it is basically tiny little holes in the fabric of stories that have been told already, and use it to enhance and tell an entire new story that would fit right into that hole. And that's really what this episode did. I mean, it sort of gave you a lot of background on the Talosians and their relationship with Spock, and gave you more of a context as to why Spock would go to them after Pike gets injured in the menagerie, and why he would fight so hard to bring Pike back there.
Yeah. Very interesting. Marina, what do you think?
I was literally my mind was blown when you know, we have this opening, you know, previously on Star Trek, my mouth just literally dropped. And I'm like, I cannot believe that they did it. And they did it so beautifully, because the whole sequence, the way it's cut, is just gorgeous. You have that transition between the two pikes, and it just ties the whole thing wonderfully together. So it's I completely agree with Heather. I am blown away that the creatives, as they promised many times in the interviews, are actually honoring the franchise as a whole by pulling in bits and pieces that, you know, we've seen the Andorians, we've seen the Tellarites, we've seen this, you know, certain things. Yes, they are adding things. They are updating the designs and the costumes. But it does feel, the further it goes along, it does feel like a more natural mash with the Star Trek universe that we know. So, you know, the whole episode, what I thought was wonderfully done. I mean, there are certain things that we will bring up as we speak about it. I mean, there were a couple of things that I'm like, that probably could have been a little bit, you know, held to a better standard, possibly down to a better standard. But the overall thing is the overall episode was brilliant, I thought. And I'm glad that it's not as short as the previous one that we had. So I actually had enough time for all of these mystery arcs that keep developing throughout the season, you know, getting very nice development. It's a great episode.
Yeah. No, I have to agree with both of you. It was an excellent episode. I really, really liked the Cage recap at the beginning of this episode, as Marina and I were talking about before the show started. It was a great way to catch people up on Talos IV and Pike and his story there. For people who may not have seen the original pilot or haven't seen it in a long time. And, you know, when I was watching it, I was thinking to myself, wow, this is really nice. I'm really glad that I'm seeing this little bit of a recap. And then it kind of occurred to me as an epiphany that, like, I know so many people that watch Discovery are Star Trek fans, and I would just assume that they've seen the Cage. But then I started to realize that, you know, that episode didn't air until the late 80s on television. And you'd probably have to seek it out specifically, because I don't know if it actually is in the run on, like, on Netflix or whatnot, if it's actually part of the streaming, you know, whatever, season one or three, if they tacked it on the end or put it in the beginning. But there may be Star Trek fans who've never seen it.
It is actually on Netflix.
Is it really? Oh, good.
It comes up as the very first episode on
Netflix. Good.
Yeah.
Oh, cool. Yeah, I have the Blu-ray, so I've never gone to Netflix to try to watch it. But, I mean, it just occurred to me that there may be, you know, Trek fans who are watching Discovery who may have not seen The Cage. So it was really neat to see that juxtaposition between that 60s vibe and the modern vibe of Discovery. So I was a little bit concerned, as you guys know, in the last episode, I was a little bit concerned about how they were going to work Talos IV and the Talosians into Discovery, but I think they did a really good job with it. I was happy and surprised. I like that they kind of changed the way the Talosians appear. If you watch The Cage, you see them a certain way, but if you watch this episode, you can see they have a little bit more altruism, and it seems like they may have learned something from their experience with Captain Pike and what happened with Vina in The Cage, and it felt like they weren't villains anymore, because they were painted as villains in the original Cage episode. And they did a couple things. I'm sure we'll get into this as we talk, but they did a few things in this episode that sort of redeemed them and make them sort of more good guys.
But at the same time, you know, there is a reminder that they're not benign completely.
No, of course not.
What Vina says, you know, like, you don't want to do that because, you know, the punishment would be harsh. So yeah, it's a different take on Talosians.
It is. And I'm sure we're going to get into that, because I have a note to talk about that particular thing here in a little bit. But I thought Vina was very well done. That was a slippery slope that could have,
yes,
easily been done wrong. And I thought it was fantastic. It was a great balance. The way that she was portrayed between her caring for Pike and that horrible loneliness that she feels. And there was a little tug of war with her in this episode, and it was very palpable. I thought they did that very, very well. I thought the visual appearance of the Talosians was really good. Modernized, but not too different. So a nice throwback, very well done. And I have to mention Ethan Peck's Spock, still in its infancy, but it feels to me more like a cross between the Spock that we know from TOS and the Cage Spock, which had a little more emotion.
And humor.
And humor, right? So it's a little looser Spock. So maybe something we'll see in the rest of the season will change him into the Spock that we know and love. So, all right. So we've all dropped our records. So I guess it's time to play a new track to a second section of the show. where we talk about what we learned about the Star Trek universe from this episode. So I'll throw it back to you, Heather Kirby. What did you learn about the Star Trek universe from this episode?
Well, one of the big things that I learned and basically had my questions answered from the last episode is that the Red Angel is definitely human.
Mm-hmm.
And the probe from last week is not involved with the Red Angel per se. Just based on Spock's memories, the Red Angel is trying to prevent the destruction that what it looked like the probe from last week ultimately caused across the universe. So, like, they've had this debate throughout the season, is the Red Angel good? Is the Red Angel bad? And I think in this episode, it kind of confirmed that the Red Angel has good intentions. Mm-hmm. But there's also more forces at play here than just the Red Angels.
True. True. Absolutely. Marina, what do you think?
Absolutely. I agree. So in this case, we have that, you know, in the last episode, we had that turning point, and now it very much feels like, okay, they have picked the direction in which the resolution is going to be heading. And one of it is, of course, the Red Angel agenda. You know, was it evil? Was it not? And in this case, we do know that it's a human from the future. We do know, you know, that when Spock mentions that there, he felt that, you know, that the loneliness, but he couldn't see, so to speak, see in quotation marks, who it was. So, you know, something is going on there, and we see this Red Angel involved in this whole, tapestry of, well, Michael Burnham's life, because as we know, that's the entity that basically saved her life when she was a child by giving that vision to Spock. So that whole part is fascinating, because it just keeps on, you know, the mystery going. For me, the new big thing, well, it's actually several things. Well, first of all, we find out that Spock actually didn't kill anyone. You know, this whole thing was, oh, Spock is the fugitive. Everybody's looking for him, the Federation, Section 31. But now we know that, you know, when Michael sees his, when they do the mind meld, she knows that there is, you know, he just did the usual Vulcan neck pinch. He didn't kill anyone. The whole thing must have been cooked up by Section 31, so he would be a fugitive. Of course, we have the big reveal finally as far as what happened between Michael and Spock.
Mm.
That was this particular issue has been brought up since the beginning of the episode. So now we see it. I know I've seen online that a lot of people were underwhelmed. They thought that there would be something bigger. You can talk about the fact, I mean, that there is a huge impact that something like this would have, even though some people are like, well, it's just a sibling spat. But mm-hmm. you can sort of visualize it as a much bigger emotional thing, because I do think that they did form a pretty deep bond. Otherwise, Spock wouldn't have come for her, and she wouldn't be the one that he's taking to Talos for. So I think it may have been, you know, a much bigger impact on a small Spock that could have had that sort of emotional trauma going into his adulthood. What do you think, Jeff?
I don't know. I was underwhelmed. I'm one of those people who's in the underwhelmed camp on that. I was really expecting something much more grievous than that. It could be more than just a sibling spat. But, you know, I'm an only child, so I don't really know firsthand. I can just remember having issues like that with close friends of mine when I was a kid. And things were easily smoothed over, you know, if their tempers cooled down. But the way that they built it up, I think, made it seem like it was going to be something much more impactful than it wound up being. It felt like it's something that could have been easily rectified. But, I mean, they really didn't show much of what happened afterwards. Maybe there's more to the story than we already know that will come out later. I don't know. But Heather Kirby, what are your thoughts on that particular thing?
I'm actually a little bit in the, not quite in the underwhelmed camp, just I think it was exactly what I expected. Because I didn't really think, like, based on Burnham's character, I didn't think it was something that was really grievous.
Mm-hmm.
Because she just doesn't seem like the type of person to do that. So it definitely was almost exactly what I expected to happen. But one thing I thought was really interesting about that scene, as much as it was a really powerful scene, but we talk about how Spock's first appearance, or Spock's first vision of the Red Angel was after Burnham had ran away. That confrontation between Burnham and Spock was before she ran away. So as much as it's something that Spock really let, or the two of them both really let affect them, it's still like Spock still had enough feelings for Burnham that after he received that, after all of that happened and he received that vision from the Red Angel, he still wanted to save her, even though she just called him all those nasty names.
Yeah, I agree, which is why I'm thinking like they actually did form. I mean, it could be like for people who are underwhelmed, because it feels kind of like, well, you know, because they still use the actors, the child actors who are, look exactly the same as at the point where Michael just met Spock. So it feels like, well, they just met. They couldn't have possibly had some sort of like interaction that would be kind of like, you know, sibling love. But so that could probably be affecting that whole thing. It's like, well, they're not really, they couldn't be that really close, but perhaps they are. And if they did a little bit of a job of showing that they did form a bond, and that's why there was the hurt, and that's why there was this whole drama.
True.
So yeah, so that's pretty much it.
You know, something that just occurred to me as you were saying what you were saying, Marina, is that up until Burnham arrived, Spock's only connection to his human side was his mother.
Yes.
Yeah.
And when Burnham showed up, he had a second connection to his human side. So that could have driven a bond that we're not aware of, but we can obviously understand by thinking about it. And maybe that's why Burnham was more important to Spock than we had previously thought. So I'm curious as to how they're going to, I don't know what the right word is, but I don't know how they're going to cover why Spock never mentioned her in the future. I've seen a lot of online speculation about that. And, you know, knowing that Spock never mentioned a thing about his brother until Star Trek V.
He really never mentions any of his relatives, if you think
exactly.
about it.
Exactly. He doesn't.
I mean, we don't really know, you know, like, I mean, Sarek appears on board the Enterprise in the original series. Mm-hmm. And he's just like, yeah, oh yeah, that's my father. So
Spock's very tight-lipped about family.
Yeah, well, because he's had, I mean, now we kind of have this interesting exposition, at least in the way Discovery shows it, where he had this difficult relationship with his father and his sister. Mm-hmm. Who knows if they're going to bring up Cybok at some point if Spock stays on as you know, a featured character in the series. Or maybe it will be mentioned, and then we're going to move on to whatever next great adventure Discovery will have.
As much maligned as Star Trek V is, I still love that movie. And I would love if somehow Cybok got at least name dropped or mentioned, because we're seeing Spock and Burnham's childhood, but Cybok ain't there. So when did he come into the picture? Was he like a later? Because when you see the movie in Star Trek V, he looks older than Spock.
Yes, much older, actually. Yeah. So I'm thinking maybe he's like a really, really older brother that just is out of the picture at that point in time.
I mean, well, his backstory was never really delved into too much, but I would love for them to at least bring a mention of that character into Discovery at some point. And the way they're going, it seems like, you know, they're really giving a lot of nods back to TOS. So I'm pretty hopeful for that. So Heather Kirby, do you have anything else that you learned from this episode? Anything that stood out to you as something new?
So one of the other things I wanted to point out was the confrontation between Hugh and Ash, Culber and Tyler. Nice. In the mess hall.
Yep.
As much as I love Anthony Rapp and I love Wilson Cruz, this was my least favorite part of the episode because the emotions going on there and the amount of anger coming through Culber in this episode was really hard to watch.
Yeah.
Because, like, you want just them to go, and as much as it is a process, you want them to ultimately end up being happy. Mm-hmm. And Stamets is trying so hard to be helpful and be supportive, and Culber's just angry. He's angry at everything.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he's angry. You can argue. I mean, it could be they could be delving into possibly exploring PTSD. That's very much so. I mean, he himself says, I feel completely disconnected. So he doesn't have his feelings, his mind in the right place. So this whole fight, actually, I thought was, yes, it's hard to watch because we like the characters and we want the best for them. But at the same time, it made a whole lot of sense that he's fighting, and he's fighting specifically with his murderer for all intents and purposes, with Tash Tyler, who, if you think about it, has probably the closest connection to him because he himself is very much disconnected. He has this, you know, well, you can have, you say, split personality because Vok, by the all accounts, is gone. But this sort of similarity, I'm kind of hoping that maybe it will become a part of resolution for at least Culber or for perhaps both of them going forward. Some sort of resolution serves. How do you reconcile, you know, well, him coming from the dead and him being two different things, a Klingon and a human at the same time.
Oh, I definitely agree. I think the anger that I found the hardest was to watch his anger directed at Stamets. But the fight scene between him and Ash was needed.
I especially love the fact that they didn't complete the fight, if you will. So they're mm-hmm. fighting, but they stop, and you have that moment like you know, well, who you're talking to, and it basically dissolves in that semi hug.
The end of the fight was kind of a moment for me. I'm like, really? Oh god, I really hope they don't wind up being besties or something. It feels like that's the seed that was planted there. Like, oh, they both have this similar.
I don't know. They're gonna end up being best friends by any stretch.
I hope not.
But I think that Ash is going to play a huge part in helping Hugh deal with how he's feeling right now because Ash went through it.
I don't know how I feel about that. I have to see how it plays out in the rest of the season.
I agree. I don't want them to become best friends, but I do think that it could be a part of the resolution where it's like it helps, you know, acknowledge what happened and basically, you know, be an impetus to move on, you know, to understand that sort of like what exactly occurred between the two.
Perhaps. But I mean, you know, I was happy that there was some catharsis for Culber in getting a chance to confront Ash Tyler. You know, it felt like it was incomplete, but maybe it's complete for him, you know, as a character that, you know, he got that anger out and, you know, the fight happened. But, you know, I keep thinking to myself, and this is something that I talked about on many previous episodes of Disco Trek, so sorry if I'm a broken record, but I can't imagine what it must be like for Culber to know that Tyler faced no repercussions for killing him at all. And now he's in Section 31, which somehow is able to issue orders to Starfleet captains that they have to follow. Like, what is this power that this guy has after, you know, killing a Starfleet officer and getting off scot-free? I mean, multiple personalities or not. And don't forget that Tyler dropped that little seed that Vok is not necessarily gone because, oh, it doesn't work like that. He can't just flip a switch and be Vok, but he didn't say that Vok is gone. He said it just doesn't work like that. So Vok could still be in there. It could be like an Incredible Hulk type scenario where, you know, some sort of trigger makes Vok come back out.
It's still a mystery. I mean, it sounded like Laurel was pretty much sure that Vok was gone.
Can we trust her, though?
I don't know. Yeah.
I don't know if we can trust her.
Yeah. Speaking of Stamets, you have to say, I mean, Anthony Rapp, that was absolutely a heartrending performance. I felt absolutely, I feel like crying because this, this guy. But at the same time, he had, you know, the character had the mind and the heart to realize, you know, that Culber needs his space to figure things out. So he's like, you don't see him really rushing into. I suppose he probably has been pushing, as his Culber implies when they're having their dinner, you know, to get things back on track the way they were before the murder. But obviously it doesn't work that way. So, but he kind of, let's see how it works out with them. Because again, you know, we like the characters. We love the characters. We want them to be happy. But it is a process. Let's see what story they will come up with to you know, to show what happens in the end. But I do hope that they will come up with a nice, good resolution for Culbertz. These two are just such wonderful, wonderful characters.
I certainly hope they do, because I was a little bit concerned after the conflict between Stamets and Culbertz, because we were all expecting it to be happy ending, right? Everyone's getting back together. They're, you know, Culbertz alive, and you know they're going to go back into their lives together. And I wasn't expecting them to go in this direction, and I was a little off put by that direction, because as Heather was saying, you know, you see Stamets really, you know, trying to make you know, Culber's life normal and making his favorite food and you know, trying to just be there to support him, and the anger that Culber has, and I get it. I mean, the guy's been suffering in the mycelial network for all he's got.
Real. It's very real.
It
which
is.
Which is why it's heartbreaking, because, you know, Stamets, you know, finds like, oh my God, he got his miracle, but he really didn't, because Culber is not really back.
No, because of what we saw him go through. And we all, I guess we can all understand that. And I was just hoping for a little bit happier reunion than the one we got. And maybe over time, it'll get that way. Before we move on to the next section, or the final section of the show, I want to throw something out there that I learned about the Star Trek universe. And forgive me, because I'm a programming nerd. And if any writers of Discovery are listening to this and wrote this into the script, thank you so much for making me smile by having SQL, the database technology, still being used in Star Trek time. The entire tricorder transmissions network is built on SQL. The database runs on SQL. I coded all of that, and it was kind of just a happy moment for me to see that bit, that little kind of nod to nerd culture. Programming culture included in this episode. I just it was such a happy thing for me. So sorry, let me geek out for a second.
Yeah, there.
But that was really cool.
All right, I do have a couple of other notes far as like new things that we learned. I mean, I suppose it's new with a caveat. That's not something. Well, first of all, we do now, as I mentioned, we made our turning point. We do now know what's at stake, because that what would, you know, basically preventing that one possible future that Spock has all these premonitions, and you know, we know that they're premonitions, not visions now. So galaxy's at stake, because he sees, you know, basically the core worlds of the Federation being destroyed by these squid-like ships that look like, though this is the civilization that probe belonged to. Another thing, and this is actually comes from several reviews mentioned this online. I have to admit, I only read selective novels, but as we all know, the Star Trek literary universe is huge and enormous, and it's yet another resource that we see creatives actually starting to tap into. Mm-hmm. Somebody mentioned that there is a novel concentrating on Section 31 that they always mention this control, the entity that actually who's in charge of Section 31, who's making the orders, and it's this control which is implied to be an artificial intelligence. And there is something that former Emperor Georgiou mentions in the episode, where she says, you know, like, I don't really feel like, you know, this is horrible, taking, you know, orders from artificial intelligence. We didn't do this in my universe, and it kind of supports that. Something that came from the books, which I hate saying this word. You know, a lot of people don't consider those canon, but it is out there. Think of it as parallel universes, if you will. So it's something that's been brought, seems to be confirmed from the novels about Section 31, that this mysterious control of Section 31 might be artificial intelligence. I thought that was a very interesting little nugget out there, and I wouldn't have known this unless I read somebody else's review, so I have to give a shout out. It must have been either Trek or possibly Trek movie who mentioned this, possibly both. It's an interesting bit to know. Let's see, what else? Well, I suppose we spoke about Ash, but I think it's interesting to point out, it's not exactly something new, but it's an interesting view on the character. It's just how split his loyalty is, because he's still very much a supporter. If I don't know if his feelings have changed much, but he's still very much a supporter and a friend to Burnham. But at the same time, he's in Section 31 and he has to follow orders and do this whole thing where, well, he's the liaison. He's supposed to notify what's going on with the search for Spock, pardon the pun. But at the same time, he's the one who tells Captain Pike, you know, like, you really shouldn't be doing the search, because you're going to tip off Section 31. They're going to be watching you. It's an interesting view on the character. I thought that the way how he still keeps playing in, you know, there's always something split about him. What else? Well, we saw some, it's an interesting term for those who have been fans for a while, the bad admirals, you know, the admirals, either making really bad choices or calls or orders, and then our captains have to rush in and fix things at the end of the day. But basically, we see those four admirals, and I am very glad to say that we don't see Admiral Cornwall there, because I keep hoping that Admiral just doesn't keep becoming this unpleasant cliche that you have people in charge of Starfleet who are really not doing their jobs. I really don't like that concept. So we don't see her, even though, you know, we saw her in the previous
trailer for the next episode.
So in this case, we have all these four, which if people noticed, you have an Andorian, a human, a Tellarite, and a Vulcan, which is an interesting selection. But it's almost like a representation. It's like, oh, here you have Federation being duped by Section 31, you know, being that, you know, those four planets are the, you know, founding members of the Federation. It's almost like, on one hand, yeah, it's Section 31, as we know at that point, still very much part of Starfleet, but it seems like, well, obviously we know Section 31 is not being benign in what they're doing. Incidentally, if somebody was listening closely, there is a mention that device that they were planning to use on Spock to pull out the memories is actually something that was supplied from by Georgiou. It came from the Terran universe. Which is like you see that, you know, Section 31 is not heading. Well, we know it's not heading, it's not going to be the.
It retains its shadiness. Yes.
Exactly. It's going the bad way. So those are all like these little things that kind of jumped at me. We talked about the design updates and all that. How about we mention those moments of levity? You know, we mentioned that Spock is very much like the Spock that we see before.
There's a beard joke in there.
So say goodbye, Spock. Goodbye, Spock.
Yeah.
Those are great. So those are just like little things that I wanted to mention.
Yeah, little tension breakers. Yeah. Because it was a very drama heavy episode. Yeah. So those kind of things are.
I'm very glad that they continue on this sustained, you know, like adding to all these threads that are going through the season is consistently added. You know, we know what's going on with Spock and Michael. We know what's going on board the Discovery, et cetera, et cetera. All these little things. And I can't wait. I mean, I finally starting to get my own theories as far as who Red Angel might be. I'm not going to say what it is, because I was involved in a lot of discussions last season, and then
Prime Lorca,
at some point that part became very obvious, but there was still some twist when I was like, oh, I should have kept my mouth shut. You know, it's a completely something else.
Yeah, I know, we don't like to theorize too much on Disco Trek. There's tons of it out there.
Yeah, online. And we'll see. I mean, we already passed the halfway point, so
yeah, we should move into Spin It Again. Absolutely. Yeah, now that we're this far through. So this is the section of the show where we reflect on the moments that stood out to us the most from this episode. So I'll throw it back to Heather Kirby. What stood out to you in this episode?
Well, we already talked about a lot of the different things that stood out, but the one thing I wrote down for this section was just Pike and Vina, and the only word it says is wow. I wasn't sure if we would end up seeing Vina in this episode, and I wasn't sure if I wanted to see her just because of the history there.
Yep.
But I think they did a wonderful job introducing her, and
the
chemistry between her and Pike just sang off the screen. Especially once, like, the look on his face when he initially sees her in his ready room, but then as he continues he's a bit freaked out at first, but as he continues talking to her, like, you see the emotions and how much he really cares for her. And I think it really brought a whole nother level to their relationship and what he really went through when he met her.
I completely agree. I had a note in here to say something very, very similar to what you just said. I was a little nervous when I first saw her appear, but I think the way that the character was treated was spectacular. And, you know, we didn't ever get to know much about what Pike felt for Vina after the cage, right? I mean, yeah. We had no idea if he had feelings for her or not, or, you know, obviously they shared some horrific trauma. If you've watched The Cage, the mental abuse that was inflicted by the Talosians is horrible. And we know Vina had been going through it for a lot longer than Pike did. So, yeah. You know, that shared trauma, I don't want to say I'm glad to see, but it was nice to see that there was a genuine bond of feelings there, and that Pike, you know, acknowledged the fact that he thought about her and, you know, that he cared about her. And it was kind of a bittersweet goodbye at the end, the last time when she was, you know, the illusion of her was behind him on the bridge and telling him to trust her. And, you know, and he did. And that was kind of a beautiful moment for me. I thought that was a really well done moment. I thought the portrayals by both of Anson Mount and I thought they were both fantastic, and it was very convincing and very compelling. So, you know, kudos.
Absolutely. They did a fantastic job with this thing. And the only one of the low points for me for this episode was I felt that scene when they flip, when they actually see they show the disfigured Vienna was not necessary, because as a, you know, means of saying, okay, this is the reason, one of the reasons why she's there. It was not enough. It just not, you know, and not to mention, it doesn't even compare to what the original series actually showed.
It was much more effective in the cage. Yeah.
And so that part probably should not have been,
solely for Burnham's benefit,
I suppose, but it's just, it's like, especially considering that, you know, you do have that, you know, a lot of people have watched the cage or will watch it now that they've seen, you know, this interesting intercutting. It just, I think that part should have been skipped.
I can see your point. I think that reflecting on that now, I'm looking at it as possibly another way for the writers to convey that the Talosians aren't completely bad. Like, they don't use their powers just for bad. You know, they knew they couldn't fix her, quote unquote, and make her, you know, totally human again in the way that she should have been. But they still give her that through the illusions. And, you know, it makes her feel better about herself and her situation. You know, I don't know what it's like to be disfigured. I can't even fathom what it must be like to be disfigured, but to have the ability to see yourself as normal again after being disfigured, I think that I see your point about it being extraneous, and it probably could have been left out, but I can see some reasons for why it was left in or put in.
I think one of the reasons I'm okay with that scene is because right after she shows her true self to Michael and they put the illusion back on, like, you see the happiness on Vina's face. You see how she appreciates and enjoys looking normal. I hate to use the word normal here, but she appreciates.
Yeah, I know. I get.
She appreciates and enjoys the illusion that she's been given instead of her real self, and that's the most important part to me, because I saw a lot of different conversations, especially with this episode and about the cage and the menagerie and how it enforces that, like, it's better to be in cage than to actually live with a disability. And one of the things I take from it is that she ultimately made that choice. Vina made that choice to stay with them and live with the illusion. So she's not being forced to do anything
right
on that front. She made the choice to stay there. Like, down the line in the menagerie, Pike ultimately makes the choice to stay there. So it's a matter of that. Yes, it's not presented in the best way, especially in the older episodes. I think it's presented a little bit better here, but it's a matter of the characters ultimately choosing to make that choice, because they're the only ones that can make it. No one can make it for them. However you feel about it, doesn't matter how you look. If they choose to live that way, then I respect that.
Excellent points.
So for me, I keep looking back, and I keep going back to that. I love the fact that how naturally all the all the parts, all the threads, all the arcs, you know, nothing gets completely lost, although that I will bring up a couple of things. But it just naturally, you know, like we see the extensions of what's going on with every single one character. I thought I have to mention Saru, that that point. I mean, he's the one who allows the fight to go on between Culber and Ash. And it's like, you can't really call him reckless, but there is such change to his demeanor overall, as we've noticed over the past several episodes, where he's more emboldened to actually to, well, disregard regulations and to find actually a way to explain why he did it, you know, like perfectly, like confidently. Yeah, he felt that this would be a good resolution. Well, not resolution, probably a means of therapy, away and in a way for these two to have a violent encounter rather than breaking up as he should as a Starfleet commander and possibly putting them up for a port or something. Obvious things. I mean, we know that these transmissions, unauthorized transmissions, have something to do with Arium. That seems to be a very obvious. Even though Ash is the one who gets, you know, blamed for this, the continued machinations of Georgiou. I mean, you can see very slowly but surely she's undermining Captain Leland, and it's all heading that way. I suspect that Section 31 eventually gonna somehow end up under her control. Well, you know, we now know.
On a side note for that, Marina, I have a note in here about the same thing, and there was a remark that there were petabytes of data that were transmitted under Tyler's ID. Petabytes are a lot of data. So I was trying to think to myself, what could possibly have been in those petabytes of data? And I jumped into my head, was the sphere data transmitted somewhere?
Oh,
did they send the sphere data to somebody else, or Section 31 rather?
That's an interesting point. Yeah. So who it could, it kind of, like I said, it kind of makes sense that it could be Arium doing it, but is she, who is she sending it to then?
The people on the other side of the time rip?
Yeah. Oh, wow. Yeah. There's a lot of things to consider, right?
Yep.
Something else. Well, now we're at the point where Michael and Spock, along with pretty much everybody on Discovery, are for all intents and purposes of fugitives, because now the Federation is going to be hunting them and Section 31 is going to be hunting them. So that's probably the leading edge of, you know, what's going to happen going forward with all these different threads and arcs. Something that I did mention is like something that has been dropped. We're still, what's up with the Kaminar? Because this is what, third episode in a row that we don't have that part, that whole part that just got dropped. You know, you had basically changed an entire species in a matter of, you know, hours, and then nothing. So is somebody dealing with that? Could they just do like a little throwaway? It was like, oh, yeah, you know, Ambassador or Admiral this and that is keeping track of things. But it just, okay, we did this thing and we're going. What else is out there? I mean, that's kind of a bit of a uncomfortable point. What do you think? I mean, at this point, it's kind of weird to bring it up because this is already something that happened, but well, really,
they're going to get back to it at some point, but who knows? I mean, there are so many threads this season that it's like, I don't know if they have enough time to cover everything.
I wonder if they ever mention if there's anything else going to go on with Talos, because, you know, they all we know is the computer mentions that this is a restricted area. But the general order never seems to be brought up, so it might not be in existence yet. So what happens and at what point that it becomes, you know, not only a general order, but it also something that the only thing that carries a death sentence.
Yeah, nothing in this episode would indicate that.
Yeah.
I kind of got the impression that the order was, they didn't mention the order, but I kind of got the impression that it was already in place because they entered, you know, when the computer said, right, when they got there that it was not, there was always a restricted area or.
Well, I would think there would be something that would actually, the computer would literally scream and go back, you know.
Yeah, we're not allowing them to go there at all.
Yeah, you're risking death sentence. But in this case, it's like, no, this is a restricted area.
Yeah. So who knows? But I mean, maybe. It sometime in the rest of the season, Talos 4 will come into play again. Who knows? That's something we speculated about on the last episode.
Something to kind of, I suppose, finish up the section. And it kind of brings us back to the beginning, as a matter of fact. There was a very nice Twitter thread done by the editor for this episode, Scott Gamzon. He basically mentions, like, how did they do? It's like very small spoilers in there for those who haven't watched it. So he's not being too too detailed, but it's an interesting point, several interesting points nevertheless. How did they do this thing, this intercutting? And I'm just going to read off because it's literally just one, two, three, it's like four or five short tweets. And he says, here's a little bit of evolution of the If Memory Serves. As I was cutting this episode, I was wondering if we could revisit the footage from the cage and the menagerie and rewatch both multiple times. The director, Olatunde Osunsami, suggested that we attempt some sort of flashback for Pike at the beginning of the episode, utilizing the footage in a hyper-stylized way. And ultimately, that proved to be confusing. Now, those people who will be reading tweet, you'll see that I'm paraphrasing a bit, but I wanted to get it out as quickly as possible, not to take too much time. Upon viewing, the executive producer, Alex Kurtzman, suggesting creating a recap using the original series footage. And then Scott Gamzon incorporated the idea, making this seem like a flashback for Pike, and by using the match cut from Jeffrey Hunter's Pike to Anson Mount's Pike. That's that moment that we talked about in the very beginning, which was absolutely brilliant. Also, Scott Gamzon, he said, finally, I suggested using the original series score, and Kurtzman came up with a vision of the 60s era transitions, which the visual effects team then created. So this you basically have this incredible collaboration, all these people through their, you know, ideas, and they finally did decide to use the original series, which was absolutely brilliant. And then, of course, the last note, he said his assistant had to work tirelessly to actually secure the releases, because you had to use all these clips from the original series, and you had to clear it with all the background actors, I mean, many of whom I'm assuming are still alive. And his assistant also was instrumental in finding the original series sounds. So those are, this was the real deal, all of it, besides the footage, the sounds as well, and the music that has been incorporated into this episode, which is sheer brilliance.
Yeah, no, I can't argue with any of that. That's all really amazing. And maybe we can include a link to that Twitter thread in the notes for this episode, so people can go back and check it out. So I guess before we wrap the show up, I have a couple of small things that I can mention in my Spin It Again section. And this is one thing. The first thing is something that I kind of struggled a little with, and I guess everybody knows I struggle with things in these Discovery episodes, but I found it a bit strange that the Talosians would care so much about knowing the history between Burnham and Spock that they require that as a payment from Burnham. I was kind of, I know that they had to have some kind of mechanism to make Burnham share that story, but and I know the Talosians want to study other races, but it came off as a little awkward to me that they would essentially say, okay, we'll help heal Spock, but in return, you got to give us your dirty laundry. I just wasn't completely convinced by that. What did you guys think?
I actually took it to, because they've met Spock before, and I took it as they were very interested in him. So that's why it's like, it's part of them understanding Spock to know what happened to him.
That's a good point. That's a good point. I didn't think of it that way, because, I mean, if you watch The Cage, they really didn't interface with Spock that much in that episode. But, of course, there's always things that could have happened off screen.
Well, plus, they're reading people's minds, whether they want them to or not.
True.
So in this case, I'm like, well, they've already been exposed to them, and he to them, which is, I'm assuming that's the reason why he wanted to go to Talos IV, because he knew that they're the ones who could, fix it. And fix it, I mean, in quotation marks.
True.
Basically realign his brain so he no longer experiences time the wrong way. So that was my take on it, that it's that they're the ones obsessed about Spock. That's okay. Why they want Burnham's memories.
Well, and we don't know, we would assume that they don't, but the Talosians may not have Vulcans in their menagerie, right?
Yeah.
Because we know they have tons of other aliens, but maybe they don't have Vulcans. Maybe that's why they're fascinated with
and
Spock.
What's more, because he is half Vulcan, half human, that could be even of greater interest to them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, good point. Good point. Thanks for that, Marina. You've changed my opinion. So.
You definitely changed mine too, because I kind of had the same reaction as you, Jeff. I just kind of thought they did it for the story as a way to fit that in there. And that does bring another level to it, that they are interested in Spock's mind, and maybe, like, especially as they're diving into it and helping him realign his mind, essentially, like that was one memory that he had blocked up so much they couldn't access. So they asked Burnham to share her side of it so they could actually access the memory, because Spock, I assume, probably has more mental training with his Vulcan-ness, and that memory was so painful for him. It's not something that Talosians could access very easily.
Oh, good point. Good point. We hadn't brought up the Talosians' struggle with accessing a brain that's angry. Right.
Yes.
And that's an important part. It's their Achilles heel. All villains need an Achilles heel, and that's theirs. And it really wasn't brought up in this episode of Discovery at all. You'd have had to watch The Cage or The Menagerie in TOS to get that. Yeah. But fascinating stuff. So I got to say that I was really happy to see the very brief appearance of the singing plants.
Oh yeah!
Back in this episode, and to see Burnham grab the leaf, I thought that was a really nice nod. R.I.P. Leonard Nimoy. I thought that was a great kind of throwback moment. It was wonderful. And I guess we have final confirmation from this episode that Spock is indeed innocent of the murder charges, and he's being set up. And we're assuming it's by Section 31. No confirmation on that yet, I don't think, but. Yeah, so we know that Spock didn't do what they're saying that he did. So I guess that's sort of quasi-redemption, and I guess we'll find out more as the season goes on. But I was kind of glad that they let us know that he didn't do – he didn't murder those people in the medical facility. So that makes me feel better as a Spock fan.
Yeah, I feel like kind of based on the preview for next week that that's – like next week is when they're going to confirm that it's Section 31 that set him up, or what more dive deeper into that, why Section 31 would want to set him up, considering they show you that they're headed to the Section 31 headquarters
next week. Well, I guess we'll find out more.
Yeah, or more mysteries will be added.
Well, that's a given. Yeah. That's a given.
That's always a given.
Lots of twists and turns in Discovery.
Something else I wanted to bring up, and this is not directly related to the episode, but it is directly related to the series itself, and it could be very much of interest, I would think, people on the West Coast who are in Los Angeles. PaliFest Los Angeles is doing series panels with casts of various series, and they will be doing a Discovery panel. And that's going to be on March 24th. The tickets are still available, and it's going to feature, Sonequa is going to be there, Doug Jones is going to be there, Anthony, Shadab Lateef, Wilson Cruz, Anson Mount, Mary Chief, Tig Notaro, who I hope will be back at some point because I really enjoy her character, Ethan Peck, Rebecca Romijn, and Michelle Yeoh. So this is going to be this panel. And I love PaliFest, but I've only been obviously to the New York ones. So it is something certainly to look into if you can make it. Again, tickets are available to general public for purchase. Check it out. I'm sure something interesting probably will be brought up. Or if not, at the very least, you have a chance to listen to some very, very wonderful actors.
No doubt. So and Ethan Peck, please come to Star Trek Las Vegas. Please.
Let's hope so, because as you know, that's my little spiel as the convention podcast co-host. He's actually being announced at more events. He will be present at a convention, finally enough, called Shore Leave, that's held in Maryland.
Oh, nice.
Along with
that's not far from us, Marina.
Yeah. It's about a 3.5-hour drive for me, I'm still kind of on the edge if it warrants, you know, going there.
You got to do it. You're a Trek fan. Come on, you got to do it.
So I am certainly hopeful. I mean, so far, pardon me, I actually haven't looked at the list for a while. We don't have any Discovery guests announced for Vegas yet.
So Anson Mount's going to be there.
But I have a feeling that bulk of it is probably going to get announced again closer to the convention.
Yeah, we got a ways to go.
Similar to last year. Yeah. So keep your fingers crossed, because he's a delightful, as we can see, he's a phenomenal actor, but he's also very a wonderful human being. He was absolutely wonderful at the red carpet premiere that I had a chance to attend. And, you know, looking forward to seeing him at the conventions. Absolutely. Yeah.
Me too. Heather, do you go to STLV?
I am planning on eventually going, but I haven't gone yet.
Okay.
I'm in the Midwest in Ohio. It almost seems like all the big Star Trek conventions are either on the East Coast or out in Vegas. So nowhere quite near me.
Well, I hope you eventually get there. We're all there, obviously. And maybe bring your cat.
I know, he's trying to guest star on the podcast.
We have lots of pets show up on Tricorder Transmission shows. Mine do, Heather's do, we're no strangers to hearing pet noises on these shows. But all right, I guess we've come to the end of the 36th episode of Disco Trek. So let's go around the horn and tell everyone where they can find us on social media if they want to talk more Trek. Heather Kirby, where can people find you online?
The easiest place to find me is on Twitter. Mm-hmm. I do have a Facebook page, but I don't go on it that much. Mm-hmm. I just go on the unofficial Star Trek Las Vegas convention group, where if you want to be on Disco Trek, you should join and sign up and volunteer because it's awesome. But anyway, so I'm primarily on Twitter. My handle is @nerdygal33, and my profile name is Never Apologize for Being Nerdy, because mm-hmm. that's something no one should ever apologize
Agreed.
For.
Agreed. Absolutely.
I never apologize for my geekdom. Marina Kravchuk, where can people find you online?
You can find me on Facebook, both my personal account, Marina Kravchuk, and on Twitter. The handle is @Drakorex, DrakKorex. And as already has been mentioned, I'm a co-host of the Shore Leave, U.S. Star Trek Convention Community Podcast, that you can also find on Facebook and on Twitter @ShoreLeave. Jeff, where can people find you?
Oh, well, they have to look pretty hard. as Heather said, I am not much on the Facebook anymore, but you can find me on Twitter @WarpFactorJeff. So feel free, if you mention me, I'll get notifications and can respond to you guys. And I'm also part of the unofficial Star Trek Las Vegas convention group, as we all are, on Facebook. So that brings us to the end of the 36th episode of Disco Trek. Heather Kirby, thank you so much for being our guest this evening.
Thank you so much again for having me.
It was an absolute pleasure to have you back again. A lot of fun discussing this episode with you. Marina, thank you for filling in for Heather as she's dealing with her family emergency. Really appreciated that and having you as a co-host.
It was my pleasure. Thank you very much for having me. And I can't wait for Heather to be back too, because these are very big shoes to fill.
Yeah. All right. So guys, out there in listener land, we will see you again next week for the next episode of Star Trek Discovery. And until then, live long and prosper.
Keep trekking.
Hey, Jeff. Hey, Heather. Friend of Disco Trek, Eric Muirhead here. My social media handle is, I'm one of the admins of USS Pershing Officers Club on Facebook. And of course, I'm also in the unofficial group. I just wanted to leave a message this week because, in my opinion, If Memory Serves is the best episode of Discovery so far. The opening homage to the cage was absolutely stunning, and leading straight into Pike's face at the end struck me as a really beautiful emotional moment. The realization that Pike and Vina still had feelings for each other, to me, that provides a really strong segue to Menagerie and TOS, and I feel it solidly plants Discovery between Cage and the events of that series. I'm also really excited that Discovery isn't afraid to discuss the weaknesses of Vulcan civilization and the very difficult childhood Spock must have had and experienced because of his mixed species heritage on a planet that values only Vulcan tradition and an inflexible logic-based culture. I also wanted to discuss a feeling that I've had the last couple of weeks and get your opinion. We know Spock went to the Mutara sector in his stolen shuttle before heading back to Vulcan. To me, this can't just be another red herring. Tell me that Spock's vision of the apocalyptic future didn't remind you of the Genesis Wave. Maybe in the Red Angel's reality, David Marcus's fears of the weaponization of Genesis have come true. What do you guys think? Thanks a lot. Love the show. Bye. Eric.